Hello, everyone, and welcome to Classic Gaming Today, where we take a look at the gaming experiences of the past through the eyes of the present. I'm your host, Tony, and today we're going to look at Raptor Call of the Shadows, a vertically scrolling shooter developed by Cygnus Studios and published by Apogee Software in 1994 for the MS-DOS computer platform. We're going to talk about that game in just a couple minutes, but first, as is usual, just a little bit of housekeeping up front. This is episode number 83. I'm excited to be here. I hope all of you are as well. If you'd like to reach out, let me know how I'm doing, provide feedback, comments, suggestions, or just talk about classic games and technology in general. I would love to hear from you, and there are a few ways you can reach out. I have an X account with the handle @ClassicGamingT. I have an email address, which is classicgamingtoday@gmail.com, and we have a Discord server. The link is in the show notes. Discord is the best way to get in touch with me and the rest of the community around this podcast. We have a ton of fun out on Discord. We do gaming challenges. We have great discussions. I highly encourage you all to check it out. I also highly encourage you to check out our Patreon. It is patreon.com/classicgamingtoday. If you want even more Classic Gaming Today goodness, including an exclusive bi-weekly podcast expansion pack, patreon.com/classicgamingtoday is where it's at. I'd also like to give a shout out to our Pantheon patrons. They are ISO, Rich Senewall, David Morton, Sam Twardowski, Sean Marshall, Steve Novoselic, and Wendell Jr. Thank you guys for supporting the show. Thank you all for supporting the show. Whether you contribute monetarily or simply listen on a regular basis, I truly do appreciate all of the support. For anyone who may be new, welcome. I'd like to give a brief overview of the anatomy of an episode because, for the most part, all of our episodes follow a very similar format and structure. We will always start by talking about the history of the game in question, the historical context, how was the game made, why was the game made, and then we move into a pseudo-review kind of section. And I say pseudo-review because it's not like we assign a numerical ranking or star counts or anything like that, but we do talk about every single game from several different perspectives. We take a look at the graphics. How does the game look? The sound and music. How does the game sound? The narrative and or story, if the game has one, playability and controls, and overall feel. What does it feel like to play the game today versus when it was released 20, 30, maybe even 40 plus years ago? We do all of that to reach a verdict as far as how well the game holds up today. And to do that, we assign each game to one of several categories. At the very top of our list is the Pantheon of Classic Gaming. If a game reaches the Pantheon, you know it is that darn good. It is a certifiable classic. You should go out of your way to play those games today. Just beyond the Pantheon are our golden oldies. These are still really good games. I still highly recommend you play them, especially if you enjoy the genre in which the game exists. You should have a good time. They're not quite Pantheon level, but they are still really good games, and I still highly encourage you to check them out. Beyond the golden oldies, we reach our mediocre mentions. This is where we start getting into the realm of games that I cannot recommend to the broad population. They might have aged a little bit, might have had a couple of issues to begin with. You may still have a good time, especially if you enjoy the genre in which the game lives. By all means, give it a go. But I cannot recommend these games to the broad population. And then beyond the mediocre mentions, we reach the footnotes. These are the games that are best left in the annals of history. I have played them, so you don't have to. I cannot recommend anyone play these titles today. They have either aged incredibly poorly or they may not have been all that great to begin with. With that out of the way, we're going to start talking about the game of the day. That is Raptor, Call of the Shadows. Raptor Call of the Shadows is a vertically scrolling shooter developed by Cygnus Studios and published by Apogee Software in 1994 for the Microsoft DOS computer platform. Before we can talk about Raptor, we need to take a step back and talk about the very first vertically scrolling shooter titles, because ultimately, Raptor represents a computer-based version of the traditional arcade shooter kind of title. While this particular gaming genre would become pretty popular in both arcades and on home consoles, on personal computers, the genre wasn't nearly as well represented. But we are getting ahead of ourselves. Before we go down that rabbit hole, let's talk about the very first vertical scrolling shooters. Though before we can talk about those, we need to go back and explore the very first games that featured, even minimally, a vertically scrolling environment. And here, our discussion begins not with a shooter, but rather with a racing title, as the first game to ever feature a vertically scrolling environment was Taito's Speed Race, released in arcades back in 1974 and developed by legendary game designer Tomohiro Nishikado. If you don't recognize that name yet, don't worry, because you'll undoubtedly recognize his other work, which we're going to touch upon in just a couple minutes. Anyway, back in 1974, the video arcade game scene was still coming into its own, having evolved from electromechanical titles of the 1960s. Arcade machines from the 60s and prior would be designed using physical hardware as opposed to digital representations of game worlds, and these early games would be surprisingly complex in their implementation, with numerous moving parts, lights, and sounds combining to create visceral, hands-on arcade experiences to entertain gamers around the world. Before the digital gaming expansion of the 1970s, an arcade title attempting to mimic the act of driving might use an actual rotating film strip projected onto a rear projection screen, with moving lights representing cars to be avoided, passed, or crashed into, depending on the overall goals for the game you're playing. As the 70s progressed, though, these physical arcade machines would be replaced by digital equivalents, which is exactly why Taito's Speed Race was originally created. Rather than using a film strip and physically moving lights embedded behind a projection screen, as had been done in prior arcade racing games, Speed Race would create a gameplay loop where you controlled a car via a standard steering wheel, with a continuously scrolling digital vertical background that moved either faster or slower as you accelerated or decelerated your vehicle respectively. As the background scrolled, computer-controlled cars would randomly appear on the screen, careening towards you and requiring some pretty quick reflexes to avoid, lest you end up in a game-ending crash. Now, I think it bears mentioning that the vertically scrolling environment in this game was not in reality an environment at all, but was rather a series of dashed lines that continuously appeared on the screen at varying speeds, as determined by the circuitry embedded in the arcade machine. It's not like the game had any stored track information for the roads you'd be driving down. It simply utilized a mathematical algorithm to display the dashed lines of a typical road at the appropriate speed, and was designed to randomly generate cars that you could approach and pass along the way. But despite the game's simplicity, it did depict vertical scrolling, which is why, from a historical perspective, Speed Race is considered to be the first digital vertically scrolling game ever created. Speed Race would be followed by a number of other racing titles that mimicked similar scrolling mechanics, many of which would evolve the Speed Race formula by adding more complex scrolling sequences, and eventually color graphics. These racing titles would become more and more complex throughout the 70s, with a number of game development companies like Sega and Atari each releasing their own versions of vertically scrolling arcade experiences. Interestingly, the concept of vertically scrolling in gaming would primarily remain the purview of racing games for years, and it wouldn't be until 1978 before a vertically oriented arcade title would introduce gamers and other developers to a different way of thinking about vertical movement in an arcade title. That 1978 title, also developed by Speed Race creator Tomohiro Nishikado, was none other than Space Invaders. Now, I want to be clear. Space Invaders is not a vertically scrolling arcade title. Rather, it is a single-screen shooter, where enemies slowly descend towards the bottom of the screen and your ship as you attempt to shoot and destroy those enemy combatants before they destroy you. By itself, Space Invaders did not advance the vertically scrolling shooter genre. But it did introduce the concept of vehicular shooting into gaming, and is widely considered to be the first shoot-em-up game of any type ever created. Which means it effectively birthed the genre that would itself over the years birth a number of subgenres and descendant genres, which further means Space Invaders was and is a big deal, and is widely cited as one of the most important video game releases of all time. As is common with any big deal game, it also spawned a number of imitators and successors, with the most pertinent to our discussion being Namco's Galaxian, released to arcades in 1979 in a move that was effectively Namco saying, "Here's our answer to Space Invaders." Galaxian would end up evolving the Space Invaders formula in a couple of different ways. For one, enemy movement would be made more complex, with several different enemy types, each of which moved around the screen in a variety of ways using one of several movement patterns that players would have to figure out and counter. And secondly, while Galaxian would still be a single-screen shooter like Space Invaders, it was one of, if not the first, shoot-'em-up title to create the illusion of vertically scrolling movement. In a move similar to Taito's Speed Race, Galaxian would use a series of colored pixels as the game's background, representing stars in the game world, each of which moved downward at various speeds, creating the sensation of vertical motion. In reality, there was no vertical scrolling at all, as it was effectively a graphics trick coupled with the mathematical algorithm to display and shift pixels on the screen. And similar to Speed Race, there was no stored environment that the game scrolled through. It was simply calculated pixel motion, but the effect was impressive all the same. After Galaxian, all of the pieces would now be in place to create a true vertically scrolling shoot-'em-up experience, and a number of titles in the following years would begin depicting a variety of scrolling environments coupled with shooting mechanics to create the first prototypical vertically scrolling shooter experiences. But it would be Namco's 1982 title Xevious that would effectively create the template upon which nearly every future vertically scrolling shooter would be based upon. So let's talk a bit about Xevious, as the foundation that it introduced is one we will see throughout the rest of our discussion. Xevious would, for the first time, combine a vertically oriented arcade display, a fully movable player-controlled chip, and a constantly scrolling world with real designed environments into a single game. When you play Xevious, you're able to move your ship around the screen anywhere you want, avoiding and shooting at both airborne and ground-based enemies along the way. This was dramatically different than the majority of shooters created previously, as games like Space Invaders and Galaxian featured vertically oriented gameplay, but the ship you controlled could only move left to right. And even for games that had more traditional vertically scrolling gameplay, like Tekken's 1981 title Red Clash, the concept of having both air and ground-based enemies and environments was entirely new. Not to mention the quality of the graphics that the team implemented for the game, which were much more detailed than prior titles. These integrated concepts and new innovations would end up setting the gaming world on fire, as the arcade version of Xevious would become immensely popular, reaching record sales figures that hadn't been seen in arcades since the release of Space Invaders years prior. Even home ports of the title would capture the attention of gamers and critics, as the Famicom version of Xevious, released in 1984, would end up selling out its initial production run in 3 days, en route to selling over 1 million copies and becoming, in the process, the first must-have game for Nintendo's new, for the time, 8-bit console. With the release of Xevious, game developers around the world began imitating and replicating the gameplay elements made popular by that title, and over the years that followed, countless vertically scrolling shooters would be released. Some of those titles simply refined the experience or presented their own worlds and enemies, albeit aligning pretty closely with the structure put in place by Xevious, while other titles, like Capcom's 1942, would evolve Xevious's formula by adding the concept of power-ups to the gameplay loop, allowing you to improve your firepower or add additional weaponry as you make your way through the game world. At this point in our discussion, we're going to leap forward in time a bit, because it is not my intent to discuss the entire history of the vertically scrolling shooter genre. I thought it was important to provide that background context, though, but beyond knowing about that early history, just recognize that the entire vertically scrolling shooter genre would become pretty darn popular over the years, with a huge variety of arcade titles, console ports, and even some computer platform-based games releasing in the decade or so following Xevious's introduction into the gaming scene. Generally speaking, most vertical shooters of any significant quality were found in arcades and home consoles, the reason being that the hardware associated with those machines was designed to facilitate smoothly scrolling graphics, whereas many computer platforms were not quite as proficient at that kind of graphics manipulation. The situation was similar to the side-scrolling platformer genre, which we've talked about before, where games like Super Mario Bros. Were fairly prevalent on home consoles in your living room, but asking a computer to create a similar experience was prohibitively difficult until id Software's John Carmack cracked the code and created a computer-based engine for displaying smooth-scrolling horizontal graphics. The resulting game series, Commander Keen, would become one of the first smooth-scrolling horizontal platform titles on computers, and would set the stage for other development studios to create similar experiences, now that it was proven it could be done. The thing about Commander Keen is that while it was a successful implementation of a side-scrolling platform title, it wasn't necessarily of the same quality as you might see on a home console. Sure, the mechanics were technically there, but if you wanted to play the best side-scrolling platformers, you weren't going to find them on computers. You needed to purchase a dedicated video game console, or make your way to an arcade to enjoy those experiences. I mention all of this because the same kind of situation existed in the vertical scrolling shooter space, where titles existed on computers, but the gap between the best shooters on computers and the best shooters on consoles and in arcades was fairly significant. Generally speaking, shooters on personal computers were slow-paced, had lower quality, fewer color graphics, utilized PC speaker-based sound as opposed to high-quality synthesized music and effects, and featured simpler gameplay mechanics than their peers on other platforms. As with everything, there were occasional exceptions to that rule, but the vast majority of PC-based vertical shooters were simply not as impressive as shooters elsewhere. Now that's not to say that there weren't those attempting to bridge that gap, and one of those individuals that wanted to advance the state of computer-based vertical shooters was an independent developer by the name of Scott Host, who back in the early 90s had founded his own video game development studio, Cygnus Studios, with the hopes of creating new and varied gaming experiences for computer gamers around the world. And because of the popularity of the vertically scrolling shooter genre at the time, Host decided that his first game would in fact be a vertically scrolling shooter, which is what led him to begin creating the game Galactics in 1991. If you take a look at Galactics, you'll notice that Host had pretty high aspirations for the title, as the game would utilize enhanced graphics, an interesting power-up system where dropped power-ups needed to be retrieved by an extension arm attached to the player ship, and high-quality synthesized music, setting it apart from similar shooters that still utilized the bleeps and bloops of internal PC speakers to play sounds for players. For this title, though, Host and the rest of Cygnus Studios would choose to emulate the simpler gameplay stylings of games like Galaxian, as opposed to the more modern descendants of Xevious, as Galactics was designed to be a pseudo-vertical scrolling game, where a star field in the background shifts constantly, creating the appearance of vertical movement, while in the foreground you control a spaceship that can only move side to side, as opposed to having the freedom to navigate around the entire playfield. In this way, Galactics was effectively a modernized version of Galaxian, and even went so far as to replicate the wave-based gameplay of the arcade title, with the game split up into 99 distinct waves for players to battle through. Now, Galactics was decidedly more advanced than Galaxian was, as it had a larger enemy roster, a greater variety of encounters, a fully fleshed-out power system, and a more complex set of controls. But at its core, Galactics was effectively a modernized version of the Galaxian formula. A quality modernized version, sure, but not anything completely divergent from what had come before it. When Galactics was released in 1991, Host and the Cygnus Studios team decided to self-publish the title, which meant that they would be responsible for marketing, distribution, sales, continued maintenance and patches, and pretty much everything else to do with getting the game in players' hands. And it turns out, doing all of that as a small independent studio was hard work. In particular, Host noted in a prior interview that actually selling his game was a challenge, and it's not hard to understand why. A lot of times, independent studios in the 80s and early 90s were created because they wanted to make games. The actual distribution of those titles was not nearly as fun or exciting as the act of game creation. And while studios realized they did in fact need to sell their titles to make money and subsequently make more games, many did not relish the idea of digging deep into sales reports and marketing figures. Which is why, when Apogee Software founder Scott Miller sent Host a note asking to partner with Cygnus Studios on future titles, it was basically a dream come true. We've talked about Scott Miller and Apogee before, but just as a refresher, Miller had founded Apogee back in the late 80s, primarily as a way of self-publishing and distributing his own games. Over the years that followed, Miller would sign a number of developers under the Apogee label, and would help them align with the Apogee approach to marketing and distributing games, which was primarily focused on the concept of shareware. Shareware was a method of software distribution where games would be designed as a series of episodes, most typically three, and each episode would contain a collection of levels. Under the shareware model, the first episode for a given game would be distributed essentially for free, either via online bulletin board services or via in-store displays, where you might have to pay some nominal fee for the cost of a disc and other packaging, but the game's episode itself was entirely free. Assuming you liked that first episode, you would often be prompted with some sort of order form screen in the game of your choice, where for an additional payment, you could either unlock or receive via mail order the remainder of the game, occasionally with additional perks like secret codes, free games, and strategy guides. Apogee software would become the gold standard in shareware distribution for games, and many development studios of the time who needed help with distributing their titles would often seek out Apogee and Scott Miller to assist with that distribution. And, as long as a developer maintained a certain degree of quality and could design their game to leverage the multi-episode shareware format, Apogee was more than happy to publish their title. Scott Miller himself had been impressed with Scott Hosts and his team's efforts in creating Galactics, and Miller believed that a partnership with Cygnus Studios would be worthwhile for all involved. For Cygnus Studios, they would get a proven publishing partner who could likely extend the reach of their games, while at the same time taking over the less fun aspects of game development, allowing that team to focus on creating games as opposed to distributing their software. And for Apogee, they'd be getting an up-and-coming game development studio, and one who they thought they'd be able to work with to create future groundbreaking titles. It certainly seemed like a win-win for each company, and shortly after Miller approached Host about a deal, Cygnus Studios would join the Apogee software family, with their first assignment being the creation of a new role-playing game entitled Second Sword, which was intended to use Raven Software's Shadowcaster engine to create a first-person action RPG kind of experience. Interestingly, despite the fact that Apogee published a huge number of games, they had never worked on an RPG before, and I'm assuming the reason for that is the fact that RPGs don't really fit in well with the shareware model that Apogee had pioneered. Think about it for a second. In a first-person shooter, or a platforming title, or pretty much any level-based kind of game, it's relatively easy to bundle a series of levels together into a few episodes, and then distribute that first episode as shareware, with subsequent episodes being available for purchase. RPGs, generally speaking, do not have levels, so a natural question might be, how do you separate an RPG into a shareware portion and a purchasable portion? Up to the point that Cygnus Studios began working on Second Sword, there wasn't really a good answer, so Apogee had steered clear of publishing RPGs in the past. Well, it turns out, Second Sword would also be unable to answer that RPG shareware question, and the game would eventually be canceled before the team completed development on the title. Luckily for Cygnus Studios and Apogee, there were plenty of other game ideas that the team could work on, and one in particular appealed to everyone. What if Scott Host and the team could create a more advanced version of their first game, Galactics, only this time, the game would be a true vertically scrolling shooter, complete with high-quality VGA graphics, a standout synthesized soundtrack, and gameplay and controls that up to this point had only been seen in the best arcade titles of the time. That sounded like a dream come true, so Cygnus and Apogee both decided that the company's next title would be the realization of that dream, which is what prompted Cygnus Studios to begin working on the title codenamed as Mercenary 2029. That internal working title was meant to symbolize the core story behind the game, which involved you, the player, acting as a mercenary of sorts in a futuristic world where megacorporations effectively rule over everyone and everything. These megacorporations would often take offensive actions against their rivals, hiring mercenaries to attack and in some cases destroy their competition. And it is one of these mercenaries that players would control over the course of the game. The concept sounded great, and with a general understanding of how the game was intended to be structured, the team began pulling together all of the different elements that would make up the core of the game, including graphics, sound, an innovative power-up system, and the various levels that you'd be expected to play through over the course of the game. Because the title was intended to be a vertically scrolling shooter with multiple levels, it was a natural fit for the shareware model, and the game would eventually be designed to utilize three different episodes, with the first episode intended to be available as a shareware release, while the follow-on episodes would be purchasable from Apogee directly. There was only one problem. Mercenary 2029, while not a bad title per se, wasn't exactly all that exciting. The team realized that they needed to come up with something a bit more impactful in order to truly gain the attention of the market. And here, a chance encounter at a movie theater would provide some much-needed inspiration. Back in 1993, the biggest cinematic event of the year, by far, was the release of Steven Spielberg's dinosaur epic film Jurassic Park, itself an adaptation of a previously written Michael Crichton novel. Jurassic Park was a big deal, and it drew record-breaking crowds throughout its entire theatrical run. In fact, that film would become the highest-grossing film ever released up to that point, beating out one of Steven Spielberg's prior films, E.T., for that particular honor. Needless to say, a ridiculous number of people went out to see that film, and one of those individuals who lost themselves for a couple hours while watching prehistoric exploits was none other than Scott Host, the founder of Cygnus Studios. While watching the film, he took note of one particular dinosaur species, the Velociraptor, an absolutely vicious predator with swift movements, gigantic talons, and incredibly intelligent pack-based hunting prowess. Besides those killer features, though, Host was most impressed with the species name. Raptor. That sounds kinda awesome. So awesome, in fact, that Host would decide on the spot that it would be a great title for a game, and as it turns out, he was in the midst of trying to figure out what to call his forthcoming vertical scrolling shoot 'em up. After watching Jurassic Park, he knew what had to be done. From that point forward, Mercenary 2029 would be known as Raptor, Call of the Shadows. With the name now in place, the team focused its efforts on completing work on the title, which would eventually be released to consumers on April 1st, 1994. Now, interestingly, when it was announced that Raptor was being released on that date, many people didn't believe it, because, as you may have noticed, April 1, or April the 1st, is not exactly the most reliable date for relaying truthful information. But in this case, it turns out that Cygnus Studios and Apogee were being totally serious, and Raptor Call of the Shadows officially hit store shelves on April Fool's Day in 1994. Upon release, Raptor would receive a fair amount of positive critical response, with some individuals claiming it was the best and most professional Apogee release to date, with outstanding graphics, sound, and gameplay. Many praised the game as an action title that simply could not be missed, and due to its shareware distribution model, the game would make its way into many gamers' hands, many of whom were blown away by the quality of the experience. Raptor was one of, if not the first, vertically scrolling shooter on a computer-based platform that truly replicated the feeling and quality of arcade and home-based console titles, and as such, it garnered a great deal of attention following its release. Some critics even claimed that Raptor was the finest shareware release since Doom, which is high praise indeed. Interestingly, and this is a bit of a tangent, but for a period of time during the game's development, Cygnus Studios would share office space in the same building as id Software while they were creating Doom and Doom 2, and the two companies struck up a bit of a camaraderie during that time. In fact, when the id guys were trying to figure out how to embed high-quality music and sound effects into their title, it was the Raptor team that pointed them to the DMX sound library, which Cygnus had been using for Raptor prior to id acquiring the license to the library for their own games. Also interesting is the fact that the original Doom setup program was derived from the Raptor setup program, and early versions of the file even had a Cygnus Studios copyright in the program. I always find it interesting how game development studios around this time collaborated, and this is a bit of trivia that I admit I did not realize until doing research for this episode. Anyway, tangent aside, Raptor would end up being a moderate hit for Apogee and Cygnus Studios, and would sell approximately 90,000 copies over its initial release window. The story doesn't end there, though, as Raptor would end up being ported to Windows in 1999, followed by a number of other ports and re-releases, including mobile versions, a modern Steam release, and even a Linux version at one point in time. Of these, I do feel a need to talk about the 1999 Windows release, because it featured some interesting... It featured some baffling design decisions that weren't present in the DOS original. First, though, a bit more about Cygnus Studios. After the release of Raptor in April of 1994, work began on a new title, Strife, which, similar to Second Sword, was intended to be an RPG. It wouldn't take long, though, before tensions rose between Scott Host and several other members of the Cygnus Studios team, primarily centered on the fact that Host wanted to relocate away from id Software and their Texas office space to return to Chicago, which was Host's hometown. This difference of opinion would cause a split in the company, where a number of developers went off to form Rogue Entertainment, who would eventually complete Strife in 1996, while Host and the remaining Cygnus Studios team would relocate to Chicago and rebrand themselves as Mountain King Studios. It was under the Mountain King Studios moniker that Raptor's 1999 Windows port would be released, and one glance at it should be enough to tell you that something was definitely off with the development behind the port. For one, should you choose to use a keyboard to move your ship around, which worked perfectly fine in the original DOS version of the title, you'd be restricted to moving at half speed, which, as you might imagine, served to make the game exceedingly more difficult than the original. You might think, okay, there's some weird keyboard issue in the Windows version. No problem, I'll just use the mouse to move around. Only here, you'll notice that if you use the mouse, you can't actually navigate to the far right side of the screen, which means there is an entire section of the game's playfield that you can't access. Having one of these issues in a release would be one thing, but having both effectively meant that the game was about as close to unplayable as a game could be, and I am truly curious as to why the game was released in such a state. I unfortunately don't have an answer, and I can only assume there had to have been a good reason. But I still stand by my belief that it should have never been released with such severe issues. Luckily, subsequent re-releases would skew much more closely to the DOS original, and even today, Raptor has continued to receive some attention, with Scott Host currently working on what he calls a remixed version of the title. He's planning to release this new version on pretty much every modern gaming platform available, and I, for one, am pretty excited to see where this one goes. Regardless of some past foibles, and without knowing what the future may hold, the fact is that the original Raptor did something pretty special for PC gamers in 1994. As one of the first truly arcade-quality vertically scrolling shooter experiences available for a computer, Raptor introduced the genre to a whole new segment of the game-playing population, individuals who may have missed out on some of the earlier seminal titles that made the genre as popular as it was back in the early 90s. While we'll talk about my personal opinion on Raptor in just a little bit, it's not hard to understand why for many gamers, Raptor was one of the most beloved vertical shooters of the time. It looked great, it sounded awesome, and it proved that computers could deliver a similar, and some may argue better, gameplay experience than arcades and home consoles. Time will tell whether Raptor will remain in the pop culture spotlight in the future, but regardless, the original incarnation of the title is undoubtedly an important release in gaming history, and as such, is definitely a game that deserves to be remembered. We are now going to shift to start talking about what it feels like to play Raptor today versus when it was released 30 years ago. So Raptor, surprisingly, is the first vertically scrolling shooter title that we've looked at for this podcast. So let's talk a bit about the general genre and key features before diving into a more specific discussion about Raptor itself. In a vertically scrolling shooter, your goal is to control some sort of spacecraft, or in some cases, character, as you move vertically along a fixed kind of flight path. Unlike single-screen shooters like the classic title Galaga, where waves of enemies come onto the screen that you need to defeat before a new wave of enemies shows up, in a vertically scrolling shooter, the screen itself often moves, representing your continuous forward motion at a set speed and velocity. As the screen constantly propels you forward, you often have the ability to move your ship wherever you want within the confines of the currently displayed set of screen coordinates, which is good because most shooters involve a ton of enemies and projectiles being flung in your direction as you continue your vertical pursuit forward into any given level. Enemies can often take the form of other ships, aliens, ground-to-air missile silos, or pretty much anything else, with some enemies being equipped with firepower to match your own, while others are effectively kamikaze-style pilots who attempt to crash their ships into you in order to cause the most damage possible. Depending on the type of vertically scrolling shooter that you're playing, you may or may not have shields available to soak up some of that damage. If you do have a shield on your ship, then your primary focus is maintaining those shield levels for as long as possible. Otherwise, you risk losing a life. Other games, however, don't have shields at all, which means one hit, one kill, though many games that utilize a one hit, one kill mechanic compensate by allowing you to respawn automatically at the point that you died. The unfortunate thing about dying, other than losing a life, of course, is that oftentimes any power-ups you may have picked up are lost. Power-ups in vertically scrolling shooters can run the gamut between additional missiles for your ship, to laser beams that shoot out of the sides of your wings, to air-to-ground auto-targeting defense systems that make short work of ground-based enemies, just to name a few possibilities. In many vertically scrolling shooters, your loadout of power-ups is what will determine whether you're ultimately successful at beating the game, or if you'll end up dying and having to restart from the very beginning of your adventure. As you play the game and acquire power-ups, you'll often have to deal with end-of-stage bosses that prevent your forward progression, at least until they're defeated. Most of the time, these bosses are truly gargantuan machines or creatures that usually dwarf the enemies that you fight during a given mission, and the bosses typically have multiple spots on their bodies that need to be defeated before you beat them. This generally means that end-of-stage bosses are at their most deadly right at the beginning of the fight, when their weapon systems are at full power and their bodies are fully intact. As you slowly whittle down their targetable locations, those weapons are usually destroyed, and by the end of a boss fight, those bosses are usually a pale shadow of their original beginning of fight selves. Eventually, assuming you take some time to learn the game and develop the necessary skills, you'll make your way through whatever levels the game presents to you, defeat the myriad bosses that stand in your way, and ultimately beat the game. That, effectively, is the general structure of a vertically scrolling shooter kind of experience, and in many ways, Raptor implements similar kinds of features. There are other aspects of the game, though, that are a bit unique, and it is those features that set Raptor apart from many of its peers. But first, I should reiterate really quickly that in the computer gaming space, Raptor honestly doesn't have a ton of peers, as the concept of a true vertically scrolling shooter as opposed to games that simply simulate vertically scrolling spaces was still almost entirely the domain of arcade cabinets and home console machines, similar in many ways to how smooth side-scrolling platform titles didn't really exist on computers until the Commander Keen series made it possible to mimic that console-style gameplay. Like I've said before, that doesn't mean there weren't other examples, both of side-scrolling platformers as well as vertically scrolling shooters. But generally speaking, Raptor was one of the first smooth vertically scrolling shooters with high-quality VGA graphics that actually featured a scrolling environment, as opposed to pseudo-scrolling environments on a computer screen, which certainly counts for something. Like a traditional vertically scrolling shooter, in Raptor, you'll proceed through a number of levels, each of which are populated with a variety of enemy aircraft and ground-based defenses, and it is your job to get through those levels, defeat the bosses at the end of each stage, and ultimately beat the entire game. Because Raptor was an early 90s Apogee software title, It was designed in a similar respect to their other games, which means Raptor was designed as a three-episode kind of experience, with the first episode, Bravo Sector, being released as shareware, and the following two episodes, Tango Sector and Outer Regions, able to be purchased if you ended up enjoying the first episode. Just like any good shareware title, Raptor's first episode provides you with pretty much everything you need to determine whether you'll like the full game, as the final two episodes are basically more of the same. If you liked episode 1, you'll probably like episodes 2 and 3. Each of those episodes are split into 9 distinct stages, which means for the full version of the game, you have 27 levels of vertically scrolling mayhem to make your way through. Interestingly though, assuming you have the full version of the game, you're not restricted into completing a single episode of the experience before moving on to the next, because your playthrough of each episode is distinct from one another. Meaning, you can choose to tackle the first mission in episode 1, and then for your second mission, you can choose to tackle the first stage of episode 2. Progress in each episode is saved, and as a result, the game feels like a multi-tiered campaign as opposed to a series of simple disconnected episodes, which I kinda liked. Regardless of which order you decide to tackle the game's levels in, the overall structure for Raptor is fairly straightforward. You pick a mission, you pick up power-ups, you defeat enemies, you beat the boss, and you return to base to upgrade and repair your ship before moving on to your next mission. Of these, the fact that you have a base to upgrade your ship is probably one of the more unique aspects of the game, and it is a way that it distinguishes itself beyond many traditional vertically scrolling shooters. Rather than simply being beholden to the power-ups you can pick up during a mission, in Raptor, your base provides a means to upgrade the weaponry on your ship. While it is true that you can pick up some of the lower-powered power-ups for free while flying in missions, and those power-ups will stay with you for the remainder of the game, as long as you don't have your ship damaged too greatly, the real game-changing power-ups are only found in your base, and require the use of an in-game currency to purchase them. This currency system, by the way, will provide the main means of forward progression, at least outside of actually beating missions themselves. The way it works is that for every enemy you defeat, every building you destroy, and every object you blow up, you'll be awarded a set amount of currency for use at your base's upgrade station. This currency, at least in the early going, is fairly limited, and the really powerful power-ups are very expensive, so the act of fully upgrading your ship will take some time, and possibly some grinding, depending on how you prefer to play the game. In fact, I do have a bit of a critique with the currency system, because outside of doing some mindless grinding, actually getting enough money to purchase the most powerful weapons is incredibly challenging. Here's the scenario. You need to destroy stuff in order to make money. But the weapons you begin the game with are not all that powerful, which means you're going to have some difficulty obtaining enough currency in order to truly upgrade your ship. And because of that, you're going to have difficulty in surviving later missions because your weapons are underpowered. And because your weapons are underpowered, you're going to end up spending a good chunk of your end-of-mission money on repairing your shields, not necessarily buying new weapons. And then, the cycle simply repeats itself. It is a bit of an issue that actually saw me restart the game a couple times, because if you don't have money, or a reliable way to make money, you'll likely eventually hit a wall preventing forward progression. The solution to this is to grind for money on any level that gives you a power-up fairly early in the level, because power-ups are also sellable back at your base, and aborting a mission doesn't get rid of any power-ups you may have picked up. So, the strategy is to find a mission with an early power-up, fight through the mission until you pick it up, and then abort the mission, selling that power-up back to your base before returning to play that mission, and farm the power-up all over again. This kind of gameplay can get a little tedious, but it is likely the most viable method for gaining access to some of the more high-powered weaponry in the game, which is nearly essential in order to beat later missions. And let me tell you, some of the weaponry in the game is downright devastating to enemies. Your potential upgrades cover a wide spectrum of capabilities, from simple passive upgrades to your main weapon, to auto-firing missile launchers, to enemy-seeking turrets that spin around on top of your ship, to ultra-powerful lasers that destroy anything in their path. The interesting thing with the weapons in the game is that they all serve a slightly different purpose, as some are designed as an all-purpose kind of weapon capable of hitting both air and ground targets, while other weapons specialize in attacking either air or land opponents without the ability to hit the other. Because of that, and because power-ups can be cycled through while you play a given mission, there is a good amount of variety available for you to customize your ship to match your playstyle. That being said, from my perspective, the more specialized capability ground and air weapons are a bit less useful than the more multi-purpose kinds of weapons, at least based on how I played the game. And some of the weapons are minimally useful at best in comparison to alternative weapons. The diversity of available upgrades is nice, but I believe there is the potential for spending your hard-earned cash on items that may not give you the power boost you're looking for, and I wonder if the number of weapons could have been streamlined just a little bit in order to provide a clearer progression path. Ultimately, though, this is up to everyone's individual preference, and I appreciate that the game provided such a wide range of different weaponry, even if some of those weapons were completely useless based on your own personal playstyle. Other than weapons, you can also pick up a few utility items at the in-game base in between missions, as well as repair your ship's shield. Repairing your ship's shields is vitally important, as in Raptor, you only have a single life with which to tackle every mission in the game. You can also purchase additional shielding items beyond your base defensive capabilities, but those are a constantly depleting resource, which means, once you lose them, you need to allocate additional money to repurchase those extra shields. The extra shields do become incredibly useful, though, because they can help you get through some incredibly tough sections, avoiding a dreaded death. Because if you die, the game gives you an unceremonious game over and simply drops you back to the title screen. Now, luckily, the game does have a save system, and the way it implements it is under the auspices of a pilot's career. When you begin the game, you are prompted to create a character, which basically amounts to choosing an avatar portrait and giving yourself a name. Once you create your character, every action you take in a given campaign will be stored to your pilot's profile, at least as long as you remember to save your game, because there are no autosaves here. There are also no mid-mission saves, so it is imperative that you save your game whenever you reach your base. Assuming, that is, you didn't lose a critical power-up in the last mission. Because, once your ship reaches a certain level of damage, whatever power-up you currently have equipped will be completely destroyed. And, because your most powerful weapons cost a ridiculous amount of money, it might make sense to simply reload your last save rather than having to reaccumulate enough money to repurchase the power-up that was just destroyed. Assuming you can maintain the weaponry that you most prefer, and you can keep your ship's shields replenished, you'll be all set to tackle the game's most difficult challenges, which is simply the act of playing through each mission. Because I have to admit, Raptor is one tough game, especially at higher difficulty settings, and especially before you have any significant upgrades in place. In fact, my initial impression of Raptor was decidedly mixed, as I thought the game was a bit too unforgiving in the early going. I eventually persevered and was able to overcome those initial negative impressions, but I do feel the need to warn everyone who might decide to play the game. Unless you're playing on the easiest difficulty setting, you are going to face an uphill battle here, at least until you get some nice upgrades, after which the game settles into a nicely balanced difficulty curve. Actually, now that I think about it, it's almost as though the game was balanced with the assumption that you'd have some high-powered upgrades, even on earlier stages, which is likely a bit of a design flaw. It's not enough to dramatically impact my opinion on the game, but it is something everyone should be aware of. Anyway, I'll have more to say as we talk through the more specific aspects of the game, but first, we do need to take a look at the back of the box. Because, as you all know, I love looking at the back of the box for these games. I love learning how different companies marketed their titles and tried to get you to buy their games. Back around this time, we didn't have a pervasive internet with every bit of information available at our fingertips. We didn't have YouTube where we could look up gameplay videos and get other people's perspectives. The most we had were magazine articles that we could read, reviews that we could read, and even then, there weren't all that many of those around either. There were some, but it wasn't nearly the level of information that we have today. Most of the time when we were making a buying decision back around this time, it was based on if the box looked cool and if when we flipped the box over, the game said something important or something that made it feel like we would like that experience. So, for Raptor, Call of the Shadows, the back of the box says, Raptor, Call of the Shadows. Your engine's turbines roar as you scream out of the sky. Startled troops look up just in time to see your wing cannons blaze. The plane bucks as your missiles streak towards your targets. A flash in the distance tells you that you've aced your mission once again. The Raptor, a bird of prey, is the future's most awesome warplane. You're a Top Gun mercenary, handpicked to fly this super tech craft on interplanetary missions to knock off the Megacorp's competitors. The Megacorps pay well, but you can't cash in if you crash out. Battle hordes of relentless enemies. For each ship and ground target you destroy, you'll earn cash to beef up your devastating arsenal with the hottest weapons the future has to offer. Discover secrets, find bonuses, and battle the boss ships that appear at the end of every wave. Incredibly smooth VGA graphics explode on the screen with a cinematic that'll wake up your neighbors. Raptor is the most action-crazed, guns-blazing, shoot-'em-up game you've ever played. You'll be driven to kill and destroy, but then it's in your blood anyway. Raptor, the all-time top shooter. This ain't no dinosaur game. Features: 27 killer levels, jaw-dropping 256 color VGA graphics, pulse-pounding soundtrack, explosive cinematics, upgradable hardcore weapons arsenal, and supports all major sound cards. And of course, there are some screenshots on the back of the box to show you what the game looks like, and then there are a couple of critic quotes. So this one from Interactive Entertainment says, Raptor blows away most commercial games. The graphics will amaze you, and the sound will astound you. It's a superstar. And then from Computer Gaming World, Raptor's voracious gameplay eats other shooters for lunch. So that is the back of the box, and that is the back of the box for the full version of the title. And I've got to say, based on what I'm seeing with the screenshots and the way the text described the game, yeah, this one sold me. Now, back when this came out, I did not own the full version of the game. I did get the shareware, and I remember the shareware cardboard sleeve vividly with the picture of the ship on the front. You flip it over, and it has some description on the back. And I used to love, by the way, this is going to be a tangent again, but I used to love shareware and getting those little small rectangular cardboard sleeves with a disc inside it. It was almost like this weird Christmas-like experience, regardless of when in the year you got it. I love big box games too, but there is something special about shareware because, honestly, shareware just doesn't really exist today, so I have particular nostalgia for any shareware-related title, and of course, Raptor began its life as a shareware title. Anyway, we're going to move on now to talk about the more specific aspects of the game. We're going to start by talking about the graphics. Raptor's graphics are probably one of the high points of the entire experience, because the game looks really, really good. I loved the design of the various enemies, the environmental details, and the number of colors on display, which for an early 90s game likely taxed many computers pretty heavily. And I remember my own computer was kind of sputtering a little bit as it tried to run this game back in the 90s. The best part of the whole thing, though, are the destruction effects, as whenever you set off a chain reaction of explosions across a bunch of buildings or objects on the ground, it almost looks like a retina-burning fireworks display, and it feels simply awesome to pull off. Other than earning a bit of money, it doesn't really give you anything in terms of true gameplay benefit, but it doesn't really matter. It sure is pretty to look at. While most of the game's graphics look pretty darn good, I do have a bit of a critique to levy against the game's environments, which can appear a bit similar from level to level. There are certainly some different elements across each stage, and it's not like each stage looks identical, but there are some that are kinda similar to each other. This ultimately, though, is a fairly minor critique, as when I compare Raptor's environments to other contemporary vertically scrolling shooters on computers, there is literally no comparison. Raptor blows those competitors' graphics out of the water. But taken solely on its own merits and not comparing it to other games, the environments can be a bit samey. That said, a special mention goes out to the couple of night stages included in episodes 2 and 3, both of which introduce an entirely different perspective to the experience, plunging you into darkness with only ambient light available to light your path. For the time that the game was released, these look great, and were definitely an innovative approach to introducing some diversity into the overall visual environment of the game. Overall, I thought Raptor looked good, and any critiques I've levied at the visual elements of the game are relatively minor in the grand scheme of things. Moving on to the sound and music, music in Raptor was also pretty darn good, with a nice mix of rock-styled MIDI tracks combined with some bass-heavy music that overall meshes perfectly with the action on the screen. That being said, there are few, if any, tracks that are truly memorable, at least not at the I want to hum this thing in my daily life kind of level. You'd likely recognize the music if you heard it somewhere, but that recognition won't likely translate into anything resembling an emotional attachment to the underlying music and themes. Sound effects, meanwhile, are all top-notch, and when all of the different sounds and music come together, what you're left with is what can best be described as an arcade-like cacophony of sounds and effects that would be perfectly at home emanating from an arcade cabinet in a dimly lit bar from the late 80s. I'm not sure if that's what the sound designers were going for or not, but that's how I perceived the auditory environment in the game. It's good, but not necessarily designed to be memorable. The focus here was more on creating something bombastic to make the action on the screen feel even better. And here, the game succeeded. Moving on to the narrative and story, in Raptor, you play a mercenary for hire who is sent on missions to destroy various megacorporations' assets in support of whatever megacorporation hired you. Your goal is to make things go boom as efficiently as possible and hopefully survive long enough for a big payday. And that's it. Literally, there is very little story provided in the game, in the manual, on the box, or nearly anywhere else. And you know what? That's entirely okay. This is one of those arcade-like shooter experiences that does not need a deep and engaging plotline in order to allow players to enjoy the game, and I appreciated the focused attention on gameplay rather than a throwaway story. I also appreciated that there was at least some blurb to provide a bit of inspiration for why you're doing what you're doing, though honestly, this is probably one of the thinnest stories out of any game we've covered so far. Once again, totally fine in this context, but just something to mention. Moving on to the playability and controls, we talked a bit about the overall structure of the game earlier, so I'm not going to rehash all that here. What I will say, though, is that the overall controls for the title are pretty simple. You use the arrow keys on your keyboard to move your ship around the screen, either forwards, backwards, or side to side, and you can shoot enemies by pressing the control key. You also have a mega bomb at your disposal with limited quantities, which you can fire by pressing your spacebar, and you have the ability to cycle through your secondary weapon loadout by pressing the Alt key. And that's pretty much it. I do appreciate the simplicity of the control scheme, as Raptor didn't try to overburden players with a bunch of deep control systems that feel more at home in simulation titles rather than arcade-styled fare, so this totally works for me. And because the controls are responsive, you always feel in control of your aircraft, which is vitally important when you're dealing with enemies and projectiles that will sometimes fill the entire screen. From an overall playability perspective, though, I do have some critiques, most of which have to do with the overall design of enemy encounters and the way those enemies behave on the screen. In short, each level is a bit of a mixed bag in terms of difficulty and the ability to cheese your way through certain missions. In some levels, you can basically stay in the corner of the screen, constantly shooting forward and barely take any damage. In other levels, you need superhuman dexterity to make your way past your enemies unscathed, or a weapon loadout that can only be acquired through spending a ton of in-game money. What this means is that for the general player simply trying to play the game, your experience is likely going to be uneven, and I would wager that some people will bounce off this title pretty hard because by the time you hit the fourth or fifth mission of the first episode, you'll either have enough resources to set yourself up for success for the rest of your playthrough, or you won't, and you'll constantly be facing an uphill battle. The first time I played the game for this episode of the podcast, I hit the latter condition, where I didn't have enough money to appreciably upgrade my ship, and the enemies I was facing were so powerful that I couldn't adequately defeat them without losing a ton of shields. This then created a vicious cycle of spending my money on shield repairs rather than upgrades, which made the game a mostly unenjoyable experience. Once I realized I could farm for money, though, things turned around, as I was able to equip myself with much more powerful weaponry, which let me play the game through to completion. Even with the most powerful weapons in the game, there is no guarantee of success, and I can guarantee anyone who has gotten caught in an inadvertent laser blast in later stages likely curses the developers, because there are some attacks that simply destroy you. To be fair, your own laser attacks also destroy enemies, including bosses, so it's not like the computer has an unfair advantage, other than the fact that they're sending multiple enemy units to intercept you, and you can only control a single fighter. Eventually, though, you'll get used to the way the game telegraphs approaching enemies, as you can observe their shadows to determine where they're going to appear on the screen, and mount a preemptive attack that could potentially kill those enemies before they can take any action against you. This is useful, but is really only an option when you have some powerful upgrades in your arsenal. Your base weaponry will be fairly ineffective against enemies in later episodes and stages, so you do need to put concerted effort into getting upgrades as soon as possible. Even with those upgrades, though, the enemy encounters are still a bit of a mixed bag, and I feel like the developers straddled the line a bit between bullet hell-styled shooters and those shooters that rely more on enemy density to cause confusion and mayhem. It's not a horrible mix, but it does feel like Raptor has a bit of an identity crisis in its overall design. That being said, the game is fun to play once you get some upgrades, but I'd be lying if I said it was a 100% fun experience right out of the gate. You do need a little bit of perseverance to get to the good stuff, but once you do, there's a fair amount to like with the title. I would argue that many console and arcade shooters were better overall experiences than Raptor, but for a PC-based shooter in the early 90s, Raptor was almost the only game in town. And for what it was fine. So overall, how did it feel to play Raptor? Well, like I just said, it is a challenging shooter experience that early on, I think many people will feel is just a bit too difficult, at least on the veteran or higher difficulties. I've heard that rookie mode is in fact much easier, as you might expect, but I didn't personally play any difficulty lower than veteran, so I can't speak to other difficulties myself. That said, I mostly had a good time with the game, though my experience increased dramatically once I obtained some worthwhile upgrades to my ship. I know I must sound like a broken record, but it's absolutely true. Your enjoyment of the game will be directly impacted by which upgrades you have at your disposal. You know how in some shooters upgrades are nice, but not necessarily indispensable? Not so here. You need your upgrades to stand a chance at surviving, and while I don't think that's a poorly designed mechanic, I do think that the balance for the earlier stages might have been made a smidge more approachable than how they exist in the game. Overall, though, I think there's a lot to like here, if you can overcome the game's challenges. As for our final verdict, while I personally enjoyed Raptor from an overall perspective, I do think there are some design decisions that will limit its appeal to a broader gaming community. I do still think you should play it, if only to experience one of the higher quality computer-based vertically scrolling shooters from around the time of its release, but I don't think it is an absolutely must-play from an enjoyment perspective. There's a lot to like, but there are also some stumbling blocks which might hamper your overall enjoyment, which is why for me, Raptor slides in as our newest golden oldie. It has its merits, and it's a mostly fun experience, but it does require some dedicated effort to get to the good stuff, and it is not universally excellent from beginning to end. It may not be on my personal list of best shooters of all time, but that does not diminish what it does well, which is why Raptor deserves its spot as the newest member on our list of Golden Oldies.
Thank you.
was our episode on Raptor Call of the Shadows. I hope you all enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed creating it. If you'd like to reach out, let me know how I'm doing, provide feedback, comments, suggestions, or just talk about classic games and technology in general, I would love to hear from you, and there are a few ways you can reach out. I have an X account with the handle @ClassicGamingT, I have an email address, which is ClassicGamingToday@gmail.com, and we have a Discord server. The link is in the show notes. Discord is the best way to get in touch with me and the rest of the community around this podcast. We have a ton of fun out on Discord. I highly encourage you all to check it out. I also highly encourage you all to check out our Patreon. It is patreon.com/ClassicGamingToday. If you want even more Classic Gaming Today goodness, including a Patreon-exclusive podcast expansion pack, patreon.com/ClassicGamingToday is where it's at. Before we sign off for the week, I do want to mention that our next episode is going to be focused on Dynamite Cop, and that is actually a Patreon-sponsored episode. We're getting back into some Patreon-sponsored content. This one is being sponsored by Dave Morton, so if you have any particularly fond or not-so-fond memories of that experience, definitely let me know. I'm looking forward to taking a look at that one. At the same time, I recognize you're likely listening to this podcast on any number of podcast services, and if you would feel so inclined, it would be great if you could leave me a review. This is not about trying to bolster star counts. This is not about trying to harvest a ton of 5-star ratings, though if that happens, awesome, it means we're doing something right. No, what it's really all about is trying to deliver the best possible podcast I can. The only way to do that is to get feedback from all of you to make sure I am hitting the mark and creating the content you all want to listen to. We get new listeners every single day, which is absolutely amazing. I want to continue to make sure that I am delivering the best possible podcast I can, and making the content that is the most meaningful for everybody that does listen. We'll be back in around a week with our next episode focused on Dynamite Cop. Until then, remember, sometimes the games of the past are just as good, if not better, than the games of today. Goodbye, everyone.